This is Continent Media number 0404, a more or less monthly supplement to World of Radio. I'm Glenn Hauser. COM is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave. I expect this edition will also air later as World of Radio Extra 49. Last time I said hardly anything about Latin America, so let me rectify that this time right away. Easter Island. Bob Combs in New Mexico reported to the SWL at QDH.net list, I received some interesting QSLs last week. Navigation beacon IPA from Easter Island on 280 kHz, a full data prepared card. Phil Atchley explained, Easter Island is good. For those who may not know, IPA is a long-wave, long-range aerial beacon running 3,000 watts on 280 kHz at the airport on Easter Island. On a good winter's evening, or spring or fall, it's sometimes better, it can be heard all over North America. I got a prepared letter when you write and then they sign and stamp, as well as a nice personal letter from them for reception in November 2000 and December. Manuel Quinteros Rodriguez, Jefe Aeropuerto Mataveri, also sent a sheet showing the various nav aids and their frequencies at the airport. Of course, Easter Island is called in Spanish Isla de Pascua, and it's property of Chile. Some very nice stamps were on the envelope, too. A possible new shortwave station in Bolivia is mentioned on the Media Network blog by Andy Sennett back on April 9th. Plans to finance anti-drugs radio station in Bolivia by the U.S. The website Narco News, which reports on the drug war and democracy in L.A., says that in June 2003, confidential reports leaked from the Ministry of Defense in Bolivia revealed that the U.S. embassy was to finance the establishment of the Tricolor radio station, referring to the three colors of the Bolivian flag, in the town of Chimoré, to be run by the Bolivian Armed Forces. Broadcasting at up to 15 kilowatts, the station will reach all across the country. Thus, that implies it may use shortwave, disseminating discouraging messages to the coca growers about the supposed war on drugs and terrorism. Narco News says it was former President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada's government that made these commitments to the U.S., but the commitments are now being fulfilled under the new administration. In the Rinconada region, construction has begun on new police and military barracks. There are also rumors circulating about the installation of the Tricolor radio station in the Chapare. That's according to the Narco News Bulletin, www.narconews.com. About Radio Verdad in Guatemala on 4052.5, which, as I recall, we brought to the attention of the DX world when it was discovered over 4 years ago. Dave Valco in Pennsylvania reports to Cumbre DX, Sunday, March 7th, 2004, was the station's fourth anniversary. A ribbon-cutting ceremony started off the festivities as a new storage building, amphitheater, and pastoral home were dedicated. There was also a parade and special dinner. Included in the special anniversary program was an English greeting to Brett Saylor and yours truly, says Dave Valco. At one point, the audio disappeared temporarily. It wasn't certain, but it seemed the announcer at the time accidentally disconnected the audio feed as he was not familiar with the particular studio he was operating from. Also, the station left the air for a period of time. According to the station manager's daughter and secretary, there was an instant electrical failure. The room was locked, and nobody knew who had the keys. It must have been an interesting anniversary celebration. A nice yellow and green pennant arrived here recently. They're running around 800 watts. Last June 6, 2003, the antenna was struck by lightning, blowing out part of the transmitter. They were still able to stay on the air with 280 watts. They've received reports from at least 39 countries and 26 U.S. states. They're hoping the Guatemalan government grants them an AM or FM license. If you decide to send them a report for QSL, don't forget to include return postage. Another satisfied QSLer is Tom Messer in River Falls, Wisconsin, who reported this to the SWL list at QTH.net. I received an aero mail from Radio Verdad, Guatemala, a wonderful QSL package, a nice pennant and banner, a QSL card, a long personal letter from Dr. Madrid explaining Radio Verdad and technical aspects as well as history. Even got a receipt for the U.S. dollar I sent, a donation for postage. What was cool, they had a list of reception reports from all the continents and countries in the world, and a tally of how many from each. U.S. had reports from 28 states, Canada 4 provinces. Even some guy in Greenland sent them a reception report. The reply came to me in just over 3 weeks, and beautiful stamps on the envelope. Dr. Madrid states he is a fellow longtime DXer as well. Hats off to Radio Verdad. I highly recommend them for those who want to see how much QSLing can be a fun thing. Again, the frequency to check in our local evenings and perhaps just before sunrise, 4052.5, far out of band. There is another small shortwave station of great interest to DX listeners in neighboring Mexico, Radio Huayacocotla, in Veracruz State on 2390. Alan Pennington in the UK sent us an article about it from towardfreedom.com, the spring issue of Toward Freedom online magazine, written by Zaidee Rose Stavely, voice of the Campesinos. Shortwave radio is nurturing community in rural Mexico. The sound of a trombone emerges from the foliage of the northern Veracruz Mountains. It plays a single note, then another. As trumpets, cornets, tubas, and drums join in, musicians march out from the pines. They've walked miles to reach Pie de la Cuesta and participate in the celebration. Blasting away, they take their places in the line. Another 9 bands are already waiting. One group of musicians is decked out in matching blue suits. Others sport ponytails and Che Guevara t-shirts, while many wear baggy jeans and baseball caps. The drums are decorated with the names of the bands and colorful images of deer, mountains, starry skies, and roads winding their way between houses. A young indigenous woman runs between the bands with a mini-disc player, recording songs for the radio. This is Lucrecia Linares, Tepewa radio announcer for Radio Huayacocotla, a shortwave community radio station that transmits in Spanish and the three indigenous languages of the region, Otom, Nahua, and Tepewa. The station's directors and announcers have come to this Otom community for a special celebration of Cecilia, patron saint of musicians. In the last year, the station has helped finance instruments for 8 new bands, 2 composed mostly of young people. That makes a total of 12 bands in the municipality of Texcatepec. The procession meets 2 bands from the community as it winds around to the center of town. As it proceeds, a crackling radio blasts from a one-room wooden shack with a corrugated tin roof. Radio Huayacocotla, La Voz de los Campesinos, XEJN, transmitting for you at 2390 kilohertz, with 500 watts of power for the Sierra Norte of Veracruz. Even in Pie de la Cuesta, 7 hours on foot from the town of Huayacocotla, where the station is located, people listen to the shortwave station. The programming includes rancheras and norteñas, regional music such as banda and trios huastecos, birthday greetings, community announcements, plus informative shows like one covering human rights and another about raising cattle. News is transmitted in Spanish twice a week, and in the indigenous languages weekly. Every day, Radio Huaya receives calls from indigenous and mestizo amigos to New York. In a region with few phones and an unreliable mail service, radio has become a form of two-way communication. Migrants working in car washes, on construction crews, or as delivery boys send messages to receive money orders and phone calls, or just to say hello. A large number of the announcements, made 6 times a day, are messages like, Angelina Garcia, please go to the telephone booth in El Papatlar on Saturday at 10 to receive a phone call from Isaac. Or, the family of Pablo Ricardo, don't worry, he arrived safely at his destination. Radio Huaya also receives between 800 and 1,000 hand-delivered letters a week. Announcer Ricardo Gonzalez explains that many come from surrounding indigenous communities with the merchants who visit Huayacocotla for the weekly market. And the letters aren't the only proof that the radio's 500 watts are working. In the indigenous communities, the people know you, explains Ruperto. You arrive and they ask, who are you? Pedro Ruperto, you say, or Ricardo Gonzalez, and they hug you. In 1995, soon after the Zapatista rebellion in Chiapas, Radio Huayacocotla was one of many community stations the government closed down. For 3 months, due to supposed technical errors, the voice of the campesinos remained off the air. Authorities told Cepeda, you're broadcasting coded messages. Cepeda's answer, the code is the Otom language. In fact, Radio Huaya is one of only 2 community stations in Mexico with permission to transmit, but just on shortwave. Although the signal reaches at least 1,700 shortwave radios in the region, people still come into the station to ask how they can make their radio receive Radio Huaya. Because it is shortwave without filters, programs sometimes turn up in unwanted places, on TV sets, for example, or the speakers in the Catholic Church. Although the government promised not to make any moves against the stations during negotiations with AMARC, it has attempted to close down several in Oaxaca, Michoacan, and the outskirts of Mexico City. Radio Huaya has asked for permission to broadcast on AM twice in the past. After a denial in 1978, the station received permission from the Secretary of Communications and Transport to transmit on 1350 kHz in 1984, but the government never followed through. Even without access to an AM or FM frequency, however, the station is becoming a powerful voice for the indigenous autonomy. The writer, Zadie Rose Stavely, has a BA from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and lives in Mexico City. That's just a portion of the article. We'll include a link to the entire article in the summary for this COM 0404, which, by the way, is sponsored by Radio for Peace International and by Universal Radio for quality amateur radio equipment since 1942. Request a catalog at 1-800-431-3939 or visit their website, www.universal-radio.com. They also sponsor the website, dxing.com. Both the Dentro Cubanos and the Fuera Cubanos might agree, but for very different reasons, that there are some things very wrong with Radio Martí. One of them is that it takes a partisan view on religion. We're reminded of this by Celio Mais in Panorama Atividade DX in Brazil, because he ran across their broadcast of the Catholic Mass. Rather, someone reporting to him did, José Moacir Portera de Melo, who may not have found anything unusual. In any event, it was at 1100 UT Sunday on 9805, and of course there were three other frequencies in use at any time. So that's when they are currently violating separation of church and state, since it is U.S. government sponsored, and opening themselves to demands by the Jehovah's Witnesses and countless other sects for equal time, if only they knew. Jeff White of WRMI and currently president of the National Association of Shortwave Broadcasters has been surveying shortwave listeners at DX gatherings. He did that in August 2003 at the Mexican National DX meeting, and again in March 2004 at the Winter SWL Fest in Pennsylvania. His complete report appears in DX Listening Digest 4059. Of course, conveying statistical information is not exactly the ideal thing to do on the radio, but I would like to mention a few other results, keeping in mind that this is nothing like a random sample, since these people surveyed are already involved in the hobby, nor is the sample large enough to be statistically significant. If I can sort them out, I'm just going to mention results from the SWL Fest here. First of all, what are your three favorite shortwave stations? BBC was first with 64 votes. WBCQ was second with 35, Radio Netherlands third with 31, RCI and CBC fourth with 24, followed by VOA, Deutsche Welle, Radio Australia, WWCR, HCJB, Radio Havana, Cuba, and so forth. In his analysis, Jeff comments WBCQ is very highly rated. It has a long history of attending the SWL Winterfest and of broadcasting programs popular among DX hobbyists. Former NASB member WWCR airs a lot of similar programming and is also highly rated. In North America, most people began to listen to shortwave during their teens. In Mexico, most began to listen during their teens and 20s. Well, here I am comparing the results, but they are of interest. He adds the current age of Mexican listeners is much lower than North American listeners. The majority of Mexicans are under 40, while the majority of North Americans are over 40. In North America, shortwave listeners appear to be almost exclusively male. In Mexico, only two-thirds are male. The vast majority of listeners in both North America and Mexico listen to shortwave for less than 20 hours per week. A slightly higher percentage of Mexicans listens for more than 20 hours per week. In the North American survey, the question next is, what kind of shortwave receiver do you use most? I'll just mention the top four: Grundig, Sony, both tied for number one, then Drake, and Icom. The percentage of urban versus suburban listeners is almost totally reversed in North America and Mexico. Religious programming got exactly the same rating among both audiences. Nearly one out of five likes it, which remains a big challenge for many NASB member stations who program almost totally religious material. Here is perhaps the most striking difference between the two samples. The majority of SWL Winterfest attendees are ham radio operators, while only 9% of the Mexican DX meeting attendees are licensed hams. I suspect the overall percentage of shortwave listeners in North America who are also amateur radio operators is probably far less than 52%, as the survey showed at the fest. The Winterfest is not completely shortwave-oriented. Seminars focus on many other aspects of radio and DXing. And ham radio license exams were offered this year at the fest. As for religious preference, those who chose other were 9% in both surveys, and a fairly large number, 16% in North America, and 19% in Mexico, have no religious belief. And again, this presents a great challenge and an opportunity, Jeff says, to a lot of NASB member stations and other religious shortwave broadcasters. The April 7th issue of Radio World carried a special report by James Careless titled The Odd World of U.S. Shortwave. Shortwave broadcasters consider themselves rebels and are proud of it. This is written for the commercial broadcasting readership in the U.S. who may know little or nothing about shortwave. The U.S. shortwave broadcast industry is sufficiently different from domestic AM and FM that it has its own lobbying group, the National Association of Shortwave Broadcasters, www.shortwave.org. Missing from the shortwave ownership list are names like Clear Channel and Infinity. Most U.S. shortwave stations are owned by religious groups, while a few others, such as WRMI and WBCQ, are commercially owned. Although some U.S. shortwave broadcasters, religious groups such as EWTN and Adventist World Radio, do not count on making a profit, others like WWCR, WBCQ, The Planet, and WRMI definitely do. But although there are believed to be 600 million shortwave listeners worldwide, including about 5 million in North America, no Arbitron-style rating service exists to report what they're listening to. Without ratings, it's difficult to impossible to sell commercials. As a result, profit-minded U.S. shortwave stations make their living by selling airtime to whoever wants it. Typically, this tends to be religious or political groups. Given the FCC's restriction on domestic broadcasting, the issues of propagation, audio quality, and static associated with AM shortwave, and the lack of a measurable audience, the commercial shortwave market is not one for the faint-hearted. Add the general public's lack of awareness of the medium, Jeff White says with a shrug, people ask me all the time how they can pick up Radio Miami International on their AM and FM receivers, and one can see it's a tough business. The handful of truly commercial stations may generate anywhere from less than $200,000 a year to perhaps a few million, he says. These are not Clear Channel-type operations. These broadcasters are willing to put up with poor production quality and content. This comes with the turf of selling airtime blocks. They can tolerate downright weird shows. Jeff White says, I remember one show where the guy was doing a chant to the angels. He just kept chanting the same thing over and over again for 15 minutes. U.S. shortwave broadcasters are willing to put up with almost anything from their clients as long as they pay their bills. WWCR General Manager George McClintock says it's still a free country and they have a right to say a lot of things. Alan Weiner says, we pretty much let anyone say what they want. Our listeners demand that we be as open and free speech as possible. They crave it. They demand it. However, U.S. shortwave broadcasters often suffer grief from their clients' programming. Even radio's renegades have their limits. For instance, WWCR learned that neo-Nazi Ernst Zündel was using his airtime to deny the Holocaust. McClintock says, we threw the program off. Zündel had been broadcasting in German, and WWCR's operators did not understand what he was saying. Even so, many Americans associate U.S. shortwave with far-right broadcasts. That's ironic, given that most of what McClintock calls militia money stopped flowing to shortwave broadcasters when the dreaded year 2000 finally arrived. Apparently, the New World Order's non-collapse, in McClintock's words, severely hurt the militia's ability to solicit donations from listeners. All in all, U.S. shortwave broadcasters operate in a strange Twilight Zone kind of world, but one that they relish. Passports Magni believes that U.S. shortwave broadcasters enjoy it so much that they don't want the FCC to loosen its archaic restrictions on domestic shortwave. He says the truth is that they like it the way it is. If the rules were changed, it could open the floodgates to more competition. An unfair accusation? Not according to WRMI's White. He says we discussed changing the rules at the National Association of Shortwave Broadcasters Convention a few years ago. In fact, the FCC asked for our help in doing so. However, after some discussion, a lot of people came to the conclusion that we're all better off just leaving things as they are. After all, under the current regime, the FCC pretty much leaves us alone. If the rules were changed, then they might get serious about enforcing them. And WWCR's George McClintock says, if it works for you, leave it alone. Granted, the FCC shortwave rules are as loose as a goose, but if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Thanks to Harry Helms for passing on that article by James Careless from Radio World. Fortunately, Mike Dorner often strays rather far from his prime topic of Catholic radio in his weekly Catholic radio update, such as this article from the editor's desk, recalling Victrolas and 78s. At my age, one has to remind oneself frequently that not everyone was around when everything happened. Victrola is not a word one hears anymore, although a cousin of mine still referred to phonographs as Victrolas well in the 1960s. Come to think of it, phonograph is not a word anyone hears anymore either. Compact disc players did not make it obsolete. It was obsolete long before their appearance. Record player had pretty much replaced phonograph, particularly among the young. The early phonographs, or Victrolas, were acoustic devices. There were no electronics because reliable vacuum tubes were still in the early stage of development. A needle shaped like a headless small nail was screwed into the bottom of the tone arm assembly. Then the needle was gently lowered onto the record, and one wound up the spring mechanism to play back the record at 78 RPM, more or less. The grooves were thick and visible, and the vibrations of the needle were conveyed by stable wires to a diaphragm inside the tone arm head just above the needle. The diaphragm vibrated with the vibrations of the needle, and if one placed one's head close to the tone arm assembly, one could hear the sound faintly. These vibes were conveyed up to a hollow pivoted tone arm, down into a beautifully crafted hollow wooden cabinet that amplified the sound. Other phonographs used a big flower-shaped horn that had the same effect. The whole assembly was wonderfully made in fine wood, not wood veneer, and not plasticized wood that afflicts modern civilization. My great-aunt had a console Victrola. One raised the handsomely crafted wooden lid, it was not a slab, and a lock assembly held it up. One inserted the handle into the wind-up mechanism and started the turntable moving. It was a large chrome-plated, heavy turntable, measuring 12 inches in diameter, covered with green felt. The tone arm assembly was also chrome-plated. It pivoted in an arc from its wide base that fed directly into the sound chamber of the cabinetry. The tone arm was of several sections, and the head assembly, at rest, swiveled vertically up and back and rested on the second section when the machine was not being played. Other phonographs used a small cradle on which to rest the tone arm when it was not in use. On the deck that held the turntable, there was a sunken silver cup for used needles. The more expensive machines had two small cups, one on either side front of the turntable. These needles wore out quickly and were not good for more than 7 to 10 plays. You bought them in small envelopes at Woolworth's, Kresge's, or any record store. The needles were polished steel, not diamond. The latter would come with the appearance of microgroove records in the late 1940s. Originally, the 78 RPM records were made of carnauba wax, which comes from a South American palm tree. The discs had a pleasant smell about them, particularly when they were a little warm from room temperature. The carnauba wax records had a high melting temperature, but nevertheless you learned not to expose them to heaters, radiators, or put them in direct sunlight for very long. I can still see our family collection, the discs spinning at what today seems to be an inordinate speed, the grooves of the record changing sheen and even slight color gradations if the sunlight coming through the window fell across the spinning disc. Let a disc get a little warped, and it did not take much to warp these old carnauba wax records, and the tone arm rose and fell in gentle undulations over a record whose sheen changed second to second. I'm skipping over a portion of this long article, which appears in full in DX Listening Digest 4055. Today one comes across 78s in flea markets and antique shops. Most of these records are in sad shape. Many have cracks or bites taken out of the edges by a dropped tone arm or an inadvertent hand pressed down on a stack of records. Many are on labels that have vanished with relatives and friends who have cherished these recordings, such as Brunswick, OK, Standard, Diamond, Cap, and Majestic. The big bands have a following to this day that continues to grow in size and appreciation, and many of these old 78s have been remastered digitally and released on CD. But many popular singers and other orchestras of those long-gone years have receded into the cobwebbed past and are known only to a few collectors and people like me who are still around. Artists like the Hoosier Hotshots, Spike Jones and his City Slickers, Bing Crosby, the Andrews Sisters, the Dining Sisters, the Ink Spots, Dinah Shore, Doris Day, Frankie Lane, Vaughn Monroe. By today's standards, it was a primitive technology. But back then, it was extraordinary, another one of the revolutionary inventions that had forever changed home entertainment. To think that one could hear on one's hearth the popular singers and orchestras of the day. Coupled with the growth of radio in the 1920s and 30s, the Victrola became an indispensable appliance in every home. Radio and records, then and now, were made for each other. How sad is the passing of time. Those old 78s belong to the age of vaudeville, network radio, a superb national network of passenger trains, Model Ts, Packards, Lafayettes, trolley cars, popular books with real hardboard covers, pipe smoking, and clothing styles that reflected a personal sense of dignity. The many new inventions, such as refrigerators, washing machines, radios, and Victrolas, represented real achievements gained by the hard work of millions of Americans who worked 48-hour weeks. Ahead lay a terrible Second World War, an interminable Cold War, the sexual revolution, the hippie movement, the accelerating collapse of the values and morals that held this country together, the age of self-absorption, a flood of myopic experts who know only their own fields, a cynical media, and several generations of youth who see no real purpose in life other than immersion in hedonism. In attics, in basements, in closets, in the ubiquitous flea markets of America, stacks of old 78s sit forgotten, forgotten like the people who made them, bought them, and played them. We have become digitized. That's by Mike Dorner in Louisiana, writing in the March 22nd issue of his Catholic Radio Update. And so concludes yet another emission of Continent of Media number 0404, also known as World of Radio Extra 49. Glenn Hauser here, inviting you to read much more by consulting our website, www.worldofradio.com.